Okay, let's move on to some problems connected with Frege's conception of sense and reference. One is the question how senses of names are to be specified. Frege himself doesn't have an official doctrine on that. That's to say, he doesn't give a direct answer to that question. But whenever he gives an example of the sense of a proper name, he always gives it in the form of what we call a definite description. That's to say, an expression of the form the so-and-so. So, for example, the sense of the name Aristotle might be given as the teacher of Alexander the Great. That would be a Fregean way of specifying its sense. So a lot of people assume that he is a descriptivist about names, and what we mean by that is that he thinks that the sense of a name is given by a definite description. That is what the sense of a name is. It's not just an accident that all his examples of senses of names are in that form. They're in that form because he thinks that that is how the sense of a name should be specified. Now, in his seminal work, Naming and Necessity, Kripke argued that that view of names can't be right. It can't be the case that the sense of a proper name is given by a definite description. And his reason for making that claim was that if you look at sentence 7 on the handout, Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander the Great. That sentence would express a necessary truth. If the name Aristotle just means the teacher of Alexander the Great, then sentence 7 would mean the same as sentence 8. The teacher of Alexander the Great was the teacher of Alexander the Great, which, says Kripke, is a necessary truth. However, the sentence 7, Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander the Great, should be contingent, because it's a contingent fact about Aristotle that he taught Alexander the Great. He might not have done. He might have had a different career, which didn't involve teaching Alexander, didn't involve teaching at all, didn't involve even philosophy, according to Kripke. Kripke is an essentialist, that's to say he thinks that there are some properties of a human being, so of Aristotle, that are essential to that person. His view is that your parentage, your genetic origin, is essential to you. So you couldn't have had different parents, you couldn't have had a different genetic origin. But there's not much else that is, in his view, essential to a person, and certainly something like the particular career path that you follow is purely contingent. So Aristotle was only contingently a teacher of Alexander the Great, and we therefore don't want sentence 7 to come out as necessarily true. Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander the Great. But on a descriptivist approach to proper names, that's to say an approach which says that the meaning of a proper name is given by a definite description, if the definite description, the teacher of Alexander the Great, is the one that gives the meaning of the name Aristotle, then sentence 7 would come out as a necessity. So Kripke's view is that descriptivism is false about proper names. And Kripke also thinks that Fregean sense is necessarily descriptive. He takes Frege's examples very seriously in the sense that he thinks that they show that Frege was himself a descriptivist about proper names. Other people have disagreed with that, but at any rate, that's how Kripke takes Frege's own examples, and so he thinks that he's refuting Frege's view of proper names. And certainly his refutation of descriptivism looks quite plausible. It may help to get a handle on what's going on here if we consider cases of proper names for which descriptivism is true. So The general claim that Kripke is making against Frege, as he thinks, is that descriptivism is in general false. So for most ordinary names, their senses are not given by definite descriptions. But there are some cases of names where their senses are given by definite descriptions. These are names which are explicitly introduced with a definition. So people say, let's create a name for the so-and-so, right? And there are quite a few examples of these so-called descriptive names in natural language. A convenient one is the names that sometimes the police or the public give to the person who's committed a series of crimes before that person has been identified. So this criminal is identified only through the crimes, and it's generally thought that one person has committed all of these crimes, but that's more or less all the police know at this stage. So a famous example is Jack the Ripper, who committed various awful crimes in late Victorian London. And this criminal was called Jack the Ripper. That name was coined for him sometime before his identity was discovered, you might say. His real name was discovered, the name he had been baptized with. So this was an invented name, and it's plausible that it is a descriptive name. The name Jack the Ripper simply means the person who has committed these and these crimes, whoever that turns out to be, so that the sense of the name is purely descriptive. We have no other fix on who Jack the Ripper is other than as the perpetrator of such and such crimes. And then if we suppose that one of his crimes was murdering X, okay, then a sentence like 9, Jack the Ripper murdered X, that will turn out necessarily true according to the argument we've gone through. But in this case, that's an acceptable result because the name Jack the Ripper simply means the person who murdered X, Y, and Z, say. And so if you then put that into a sentence like 9 and say the murderer of X murdered X, that turns out to be a necessary truth in just the way that the sentence 8, the teacher of Alexander the Great was the teacher of Alexander the Great, is a necessary truth. They're both what logicians call tautologies. Now, I'll just mention a slight subtlety here. I'm simplifying this issue somewhat because it's more complicated than it might look. If you look at sentence 9, Jack the Ripper murdered X, I've been saying, well, the name Jack the Ripper is a descriptive name. So sentence 9 comes out as necessarily true, but in the case of descriptive names, that's okay. That's what we expect. By contrast with 7, Aristotle was a teacher of Alexander the Great, where we were saying that the name Aristotle is not a descriptive name. It doesn't mean the teacher of Alexander the Great, so that the sentence 7 should not come out as a necessity. It should come out as a contingency. And now you might object that sentence 9 has a contingent reading in the sense that Jack the Ripper, that name, although it's been given an explicit meaning, which includes that it means the murderer of X, nevertheless, that name homes in on a particular individual, and that particular individual might not have murdered X. It is contingent that that particular individual committed that crime. So that you might say there's a contingent reading of 9, which we could specify by eking out 9 in the following way, as whoever in fact murdered X, whoever in fact is Jack the Ripper, might not have murdered X. Because there's a sense in which that very person who did in fact murder X might not have done so. However, this subtlety, I think, doesn't upset Kripke's point, because the difference between 7 on the one hand and 8 and 9 on the other is that although 9 has this contingent reading, and incidentally so does 8, there's a reading on which you might say the teacher of Alexander the Great might not have been the teacher of Alexander the Great. Right? There's a contingency in there. The person who actually taught Alexander the Great might not have done so. So there is a reading of 8 on which it comes out contingent, as of 9. There are also readings on which 8 and 9 come out as necessary, where they're expressing tautologies, as I said before, where you're simply saying that whoever taught Alexander the Great taught Alexander the Great, whoever murdered X murdered X. And you're not really talking about, you're not really trying to home in on a particular individual and say of him that he murdered X. You're rather talking about whoever it is who satisfies the description. Right, so you're saying whoever killed X, Y, and Z, whoever it turns out to be, well, that person killed X. And that does sound like a necessary truth. That does sound like a tautology. And the point is that there is that reading of 8 and 9, under which they come out as necessities, whereas there is no such reading, according to Kripke, of 7. It's just contingent that Aristotle, that very man, taught Alexander the Great. There's no sense in which it was necessary, because there's no sense in which the name Aristotle means the teacher of Alexander the Great. So the point would be that though there are examples of names whose senses are given by definite descriptions, they're special cases. Most ordinary proper names, according to Kripke, do not have descriptions as their senses. They are associated much more directly with objects. And the idea here is that there's an original act of baptism, if you like, of naming something in a community. The members of the community agree to call an object, a person, say, so-and-so, and that name, as it were, is fixed to that object by direct ostension, by direct pointing. That object is Aristotle. And then it gets passed down from speaker to speaker. And that's quite different from the origin of the name Jack the Ripper, say, in my example, because there we don't have a perceptual confrontation with the object initially. We don't know what the object is. We don't know who has committed these murders. And we construct a name and attach it not to an object in that baptismal way, but by saying we'll call Jack the Ripper whoever it is that satisfies the following definite description. Right, so we have a purely linguistic definition of the meaning of the name Jack the Ripper. We don't have any kind of pointing to an object in the world in a perceptual episode, as we normally do when names are conferred on things. Okay, that's all I'll say about that question for the moment. Let's move on to the question whether the senses of names can vary from speaker to speaker. So, in communication, is it important that communicators associate the same sense with a given name in order to communicate with it, or can they associate different senses? Now, Frege says two different things about this. There's a famous footnote near the beginning of On Sense and Reference where he considers the question, and he says that it doesn't matter if sense varies from speaker to speaker. So if I associate one sense with the name Aristotle and you associate another sense, we can still communicate perfectly successfully with that name. So I might associate the description the teacher of Alexander the Great with the name Aristotle. You might associate the description the writer of the categories. But, says Frege, that won't matter in practice. That won't upset ordinary communication. He says, so long as the thing referred to remains the same, variations in sense may be tolerated. But much later on in his career, towards the end of it, in his essay The Thought, which he wrote in 1919, he took the opposite line, and there he thinks of communication as the sharing of senses, so that what it is for two speakers to communicate is for them to entertain the same sense, to grasp the same sense, so that if they fail to do that, that would be a breakdown in communication. So how do we resolve this apparent contradiction? Well, it seems to me that the answer to the question, do communicators have to share senses, is that it depends. It depends on exactly what we want the notion of sense for. In the later essay, in The Thought, you might say, well, it's simply definitional there, that sense is what gets communicated. So sense there is introduced as whatever it is that speakers share when they communicate. So the language of sense, the language of grasping the same sense, would just be a way of talking about communication, a way of modelling, if you like, what's going on in communication. But back in the essay on sense and reference, that's not how the notion of sense was originally introduced. Remember, that's the essay in which Frege introduces the notion of sense and says we need it. And we need it, recall, in order to solve the informativeness problem. How is it that an identity statement like Hesperus is phosphorus can be informative when one such as Hesperus is apparently trivial? The two names share the same reference, so, reasoned Frege, there must be more to meaning than reference, because otherwise both sentences would have the same informativeness status. They would have the same cognitive value, but they don't. One is informative and the other isn't. So we need to recognise an extra dimension to meaning, which he called sense, beyond reference. And as we said, he described sense as a mode of presentation of reference and elucidated the Hesperus and Phosphorus example by saying, well, the planet Venus presents itself in two different ways, as a morning appearance and as an evening appearance. So these two different appearances are associated with two different modes of presentation. And so it was quite natural for people to use one name for the morning appearance and then another name for the evening appearance before they realized that this was the same planet reappearing. So in that case, we model the informativeness of a sentence like Hesperus is phosphorus by saying, well, the two names differ in sense, they differ in mode of presentation. And what that meant was, well, you can think of the planet down one vista, as I think I put it, if you remember the art gallery analogy. You can think of the object down one avenue. And then you can also think of the same object on a different avenue, and it may not be immediately apparent to you that these two avenues are homing in on the same object. So here, sense means something like a way of thinking about an object. So we're not concerned here with communication, notice. We're concerned really with an individual thinking about an object. And we're saying, well, that individual can think of that object in different ways, which is why a sentence like Hesperus is phosphorus can be informative. And so senses are simply modes of presentation, ways of thinking about an object. So they're cognitive roots to an object, rather than what is constant in communication. So Frege had two different conceptions of sense, and I think we need to keep them separate. And then I think the answer to the question, well, does variation of sense matter in communication, will depend on which conception we have in mind. And, you know, the famous footnote at the beginning of On Sense and Reference, which says, well, variation in sense doesn't really matter so long as the object referred to remains the same. That's okay for the cognitive conception of sense. because I may think of an object and one mode of presentation. You may think of the same object and a completely different mode of presentation. And we may still communicate perfectly successfully using the same name about that object, even though we're thinking about it in quite different ways. And that's no problem. Indeed, you might say that's actually the whole point of proper names, is that they enable precisely that. They're a convenient linguistic device which enables us to communicate about objects. Objects which we all have access to in some sense, but we have different accesses to these objects. So we think of the objects we're communicating about in different ways. But so long as we share the same name, and so long as that name in our various uses of it does home in on the same object, then indeed we're communicating, even though our roots to that object are quite different. So if you're thinking of sense as mode of presentation, as a cognitive route to the object, then Frege is right to say in that footnote that variation in sense need not matter so long as the referent remains the same. But if, on the other hand, we're defining sense, or in some way regarding it as what is constant in communication, then obviously it's going to follow straight away that variation in sense is not tolerable in communication, just by definition, just because that's how we've set up the terminology. Whatever it is that communicators share, we're saying that is sense. We can't then go on in the next breath to say, well, it doesn't matter if they don't. They can still communicate. No, if they don't share senses, then they're not communicating. That's how we've set the terminology up. And you might say, well, there must be something that communicators are sharing. Even if they think of the referent in very different ways, still, they're using the same name to home in on the same object. So we can, as it were, abstract from their different cognitive roots to that object. We can thin out the richness of the cognitive detail, if you like, and think of these speakers as homing in on that object in some way or other. And then that very abstract route to the referent, if you like, will be its sense in this later Fregean conception of sense as what gets shared in communication, what we might call semantic sense. So semantic sense will be a thin version of cognitive sense. And for two names to share the same semantic sense will just be for them to present the same object. Right. And for two uses of a name to share the same sense in this semantic sense of sense, so for communication with them to be possible, that will just be for them to home in on the same object in some way or other. And the particular root that I associate with the name Aristotle, say, may be quite different from the particular root that you associate with that name, but so long as these roots home in on the same object, they have the same semantic sense. They present that object, we might say, in some way or other. And that's all that it takes for them to share the same semantic sense. Okay, let's move on to another aspect now. So that's another point to take a break, if you want. And we'll now consider the question whether you can have sense without reference. Can you have a name which has sense but doesn't refer to anything? Well, Frege's answer to that is that you can, and he gives a number of examples, including fictional names, but they raise special considerations, and I'm not going to say anything about them here. I don't myself think that they're a case of names that have sense without reference, but as I say, they raise very special considerations. So let's consider ordinary non-fictional examples, like the name Vulcan, which I mentioned last time, the name of what people thought of as a planet between Mercury and the Sun, influencing Mercury's orbit. So Frege would have said about that case that it's a name which has sense but no reference. Now, if Frege was thinking about senses of names as definite descriptions, as his examples seem to imply, then that makes sense, because you can have empty definite descriptions, that's to say, definite descriptions that don't apply to anything, that aren't true of anything, but which are still meaningful. So the famous example that Russell uses is the King of France. So when Russell was writing, and it's still true, there was no King of France. Nevertheless, the definite description, the King of France, seems to make sense, and you seem to be able to put it meaningfully into sentences. So it seems to be the case that definite descriptions can be empty, can lack an object, lack a satisfying object, an object that they are true of, without forfeiting meaningfulness. And so it seems to also make sense that if the sense of a name is given by a definite description, then if that definite description is empty, you will have a case of a name which has sense but no reference. The sense will be given by that definite description, but there will be no object, no referent. And I mean, in the Jack the Ripper example that I gave a moment ago, you know, it might have turned out that there wasn't any one person who committed all these murders. People assumed that there was a single person responsible for a string of murders, but perhaps, I mean, in fact, that was right, but it might have been a mistake. And then the name Jack the Ripper wouldn't have ended up referring to anyone, you might say. The definite description that it was associated with would have been empty. It wouldn't have been satisfied by anything. And Frege has examples of empty definite descriptions, like the greatest prime number. There is no greatest prime number, of course. Euclid proved that. So that definite description isn't satisfied by anything. Nevertheless, the description seems perfectly meaningful. The problem with the idea of sense without reference in the case of proper names is that if you're thinking of sense, as Frege did, as mode of presentation, then a name which had sense but no reference would be a name that was associated with a mode of presentation, all right, but a mode of presentation that presented nothing. A route to nowhere, if you like. And that seems a difficult idea. If there is a mode of presentation, one wants to say, surely something is being presented. And an alternative conception of sense that some philosophers have developed recently involves denying that you can have sense without reference. These philosophers take the metaphor of mode of presentation very seriously and say, well, you can't have a mode of presentation of nothing. If you've got a presentation, then something is being presented. So there must be a referent at the end of the relation of sense. So if a name has sense, it also has reference. And the terminology of de re sense is sometimes applied to this kind of sense. So that's a Latin phrase meaning, literally it means about the thing, which is rather vague, but it's used, the phrase de re is used in this context to mean a direct mode of presentation of an object. So not mediated by a definite description, a cognitively direct route to the object. So typically one has a de re sense if one has encountered the object perceptually and can think of it, can remember it. You have, as it were, a direct route to that object. You don't need to think of it via some kind of description or some kind of criterion, some kind of means of recognizing it. You've, as it were, got it in your mind, the object itself. And on this de re conception of sense, part of the conception is that you can't have sense without reference. A mode of presentation is a mode of presentation of something. You've got an object in mind, and if there's nothing there, then there can't be a presentation of it either. So the name would be meaningless. If it doesn't refer to anything, then it doesn't have a sense either, and so the name would be meaningless. Now, on this conception of sense, de re sense, we can still say, as Frege wanted to say, that understanding is a matter of grasping sense. So understanding a proper name is a matter of grasping its sense. But whereas for Frege, that didn't necessarily involve thinking about, cognizing the referent, on the De Re conception it does, because the sense is a direct route to the reference. So in grasping a De Re sense, you necessarily think of the referent. It's in your mind, that object. And that's why if there is no object there for some reason, then you haven't got it in mind at all. There isn't a presentation either. Whereas on the Fregean view, which allows sense without reference, you can understand a name, you can grasp its sense, even if it doesn't refer to anything, even if there's no object there, so that the sense doesn't lead anywhere, as it were. It's a mode of presentation of nothing. And as I said, that's awkward with the metaphor of mode of presentation. It makes more sense if you think of sense descriptively, as Frege obviously was at least tempted to do, because there you can say, well, you have the definite description in mind, but whether that definite description is true of anything, that's another question. You don't need to know that, and you certainly don't need to think of the object, and maybe it isn't. So in the case of a description like the greatest prime number, you can understand that expression, you can grasp it, but it's not satisfied by anything, and that, in a sense, doesn't really matter to your understanding of the expression. And similarly, if you have a descriptive name like Jack the Ripper, you can grasp the description that is associated with that name, the murderer of X, Y, and Z. And even if it turns out that there is nobody who committed these murders, so nothing satisfies the description, and therefore the name doesn't apply to anyone, there's still a sense in which you've understood that name. But on the De Re conception of a proper name, and I mean, the point here is that if you follow the De Re conception, you don't need to deny that there are descriptive names, but you would be arguing that at least for many ordinary proper names, and particularly names given to people in acts of baptism, these names have De Re sense, which means that if it turns out that there was never any object there, if people were victims of some kind of hallucination or illusion of some sort, and it turns out that there is no object at the end of this purported mode of presentation, then there isn't a mode of presentation either, and then there isn't a sense, and so the name is senseless, it's meaningless. So how does this conception of names deal with some of the difficult cases, like, say, the case Vulcan? Don't we want to say that astronomers who were discussing Vulcan in the 19th century, they weren't talking nonsense, they were exchanging meaningful sentences? Yes, we do want to say that, and we can on this De Re conception of sense, because we would simply say, as I was saying before, that Vulcan is a descriptive name. Its name is given by that particular definite description, that's to say, the planet which orbits the sun between Mercury and the sun, that's the definite description associated with it. It then turned out that that description was empty, it didn't apply to anything. There was no such planet. But of course, as we've said, that doesn't stop the description being meaningful. It goes on being meaningful, even though it doesn't apply to anything. Because phrases of the form the so-and-so descriptions don't depend for their meaningfulness on whether or not there is an object out there satisfying them, which they're true of. And you might say, well, that's actually a consequence of the principle of compositionality, really, because definite descriptions, phrases of the form the so-and-so, are complex. They're put together out of the definite article, the, plus what Frege called a concept word, what we'd normally now call a predicate. So, you know, the tallest man in the world, the fastest runner in the world, the greatest prime number, the tree at the bottom of my garden, these are all definite descriptions put together out of bits of language that are independently meaningful, right? So if you take that last example, the tree at the bottom of my garden, that definite description, all the components of that definite description are meaningful and occur in other contexts. And according to the principle of compositionality, the meaning of that definite description will be a function of the meanings of those components and the way they're put together. And if they're independently meaningful and you put them together in a grammatically permitted way, then you will get a meaningful complex expression. So that if I say to you, look, the tree at the bottom of my garden is a poplar, you understand that, I hope. You may not be able to visualise what a poplar is, but you know it's a sort of tree. So you've understood what I've said. You don't know whether it's true or not. So you don't know whether there is a tree at the bottom of my garden, and if there is, whether it's a poplar. But you've still understood what I said. And in fact, if there's no tree at the bottom of my garden, nevertheless, you've understood what I've said. So you've understood what I said, and that expression, the tree at the bottom of my garden, is meaningful whether or not it's satisfied by anything, simply in virtue of application of the principle of compositionality. But now the point about proper names, genuine names, names that don't abbreviate definite descriptions, so not like the Jack the Ripper case, which does in some sense abbreviate a definite description, but genuine names that are given to objects in acts of baptism. The idea behind the De Re conception is that these names don't abbreviate definite descriptions. They have a direct connection to the object, so that when one uses a name and when one understands it, one has the object in mind. One homes in on directly on the object. One doesn't have any kind of intermediary in mind, or just a linguistic expression. One can actually think of the object. You might be able to remember it, say. What does the alternative De Re conception of names say about some of the awkward customers, the cases where Frege and others would say, oh, here we have a case of a name which has sense but no reference? Well, the answer is that in these cases, they're really descriptive names. So Vulcan, the name Vulcan is actually a descriptive name. It's not a genuine proper name. It wasn't conferred on an object as a consequence of a perceptual encounter. This is a crucial thing. People didn't observe Vulcan first and then say, oh, we'll call that object Vulcan. There was no such act of baptism. The name was set up as a descriptive name. The astronomers Le Verrier and his followers said, we think there is an object, a planet orbiting the sun, but closer than Mercury. We haven't seen it, and maybe we can't see it, but we think it's there because of the strange features of Mercury's orbit, so we'll christen it, we'll call it Vulcan. But there was no such object, so the name is empty, but we can save its meaningfulness if we analyse it as a descriptive name. Right? And that, as I say, is the natural thing to do anyway, because there was no perceptual encounter with an object. The name was set up and explicitly associated with a definite description. I mean, actually, Le Verrier did the same sort of thing with Neptune, as I think I mentioned. Neptune was initially identified by its effects, and it was only later observed. Now, I'm not quite sure at what historical point the name Neptune came in, but let's just assume that it came in right from the beginning. So Le Verrier said, oh, there must be a planet somewhere around here because I can detect its gravitational effects. Let's call it Neptune. And then people pointed their telescopes at the place that he'd identified, and lo and behold, they saw a planet. And they said, oh, that's Neptune. So that's an interesting case because there, if that's how it happened, you'd have a name that started off as a descriptive name, meaning the planet or the object, whatever it is, that is having these and these gravitational effects on other planets. So that's a descriptive meaning for the name Neptune. But then as soon as they encountered it perceptually through a telescope, they were then able to point at it directly, and the name then became a genuine name for that very object. And so probably it would have gone on being called Neptune, and that name would have continued to be associated with that planet once they'd identified it, once they'd seen it. Even if it was later ascertained that Le Verrier had been wrong and that it wasn't responsible for the things that he thought it was. So I think he identified it because of its gravitational effects on Uranus. But suppose that something else had been responsible for that, not the planet Neptune. So discovering it, as it were, had been a piece of good luck. It had been discovered by accident, by mistake, in a way. The name would have ceased to be a descriptive name and would have been associated with that object, just as actually happened. And in this counterfactual scenario that I'm imagining, the fact that the definite description which started out life as giving the sense of the name Neptune, that would be abandoned because the object is thought no longer to satisfy that description. And the name would no longer be associated with that description at all. It would be associated directly with an object, with the object, the planet, that you can see. There it is in the sky. So that would be a bit like the case I'm imagining there. I'm sort of probably getting you confused here by imagining this hypothetical scenario. But a similar sort of case would be if Jack the Ripper, so if that name starts off being associated with the definite description, the murderer of X, Y, and Z, and then it turns out, once the person has been identified, that actually, although he did murder X and Y, he didn't murder Z, that was somebody else. People might go on using that name for that person once they'd identified him, and then it would be taking over as a genuine name. So they would mean that person, here I point at the actual murderer. And the description itself would lapse because it's no longer accurate. So the name would move from being a descriptive name to a genuine name. Now, Frege, as we mentioned, introduced the notion of sense to solve the Hesperus-Phosphorus puzzle, to account for the informativeness of certain identity statements as opposed to the triviality of other ones. And on his approach, as we've said, you don't have to think about the object that the name refers to. There might not even be an object. You have to grasp the sense of the name. And because he allows there to be sense without reference, he doesn't insist that you cognize the object, as we might put it, that you have the object in mind. The only thing you need to have in mind is the sense of the name. And that sense may or may not home in on an object. And of course, he solves the Hesperus-Phosphorus puzzle by saying that the senses of the two names, Hesperus and Phosphorus, are different, or rather, putting it the other way around, the whole idea of sense is introduced to model the fact that you can understand the identity statement Hesperus is Phosphorus without knowing that it's true, and you can learn something from that sentence. You can come to know that it's true, and you acquire information when you do that. And so he models that by saying, well, these two names differ in sense. They present, in fact, the same planet differently. But given that he's allowing that you can have sense without reference, the object really doesn't play a role in that solution. All he's saying there, all he needs to say for his own purposes, is that the two names have different senses. Whether or not they present an object, that's a further question, and it doesn't matter, really. In grasping one sense, you don't automatically grasp the other sense. These are different senses, as we've said. So, of course, an identity statement involving two different names with two different senses can be informative. Now, for the identity statement to be true, there has to be an object that the senses home in on. But for Frege, the reach of your mind, as it were, doesn't need to extend further in the direction of the object than the senses. Those are the only things you need to grasp. As far as you're concerned, at least initially, there might not be any objects. You know, in a sense, you don't know any better. But the alternative De Re conception will say, it will keep the basic outline of Frege's solution. It will say, well, yes, these two names have two different senses, and that models, explains how one identity statement can be informative, Hesperus is Phosphorus, whereas the other one, Hesperus is trivial. You grasp different senses in grasping, in understanding these two names. But of course, on the De Re conception of sense, the sense really does home in on the object. Not only do you grasp the senses, but you also have the object in mind. you have a direct perceptual encounter with it. If these are genuine names, we'll just assume that they are. That's actually a further point, but let's just assume for the sake of illustration that these are genuine names like your name, my name, that have been conferred in an act of baptism in a perceptual encounter. So the name Hesperus was conferred on the planet Venus as a result of sightings of it in the evening, the name Phosphorus as a result of sightings of it in the morning. And then at some stage, astronomers started to wonder whether, in fact, it wasn't the same planet. Is Hesperus Phosphorus, they asked themselves. Some probably denied it, some affirmed it, and eventually it was discovered that indeed Hesperus is Phosphorus, and that was a useful piece of new information. And the De Re approach says that when you understand the name Hesperus, you are thinking of the planet down a particular vista, down a particular avenue, a sort of evening avenue, if you like. Whereas when you understand the name Phosphorus, you're thinking of it in a morning way. So you're thinking of the same object each time, but you're thinking of it in different ways, from different directions. Remember the art gallery analogy. It's as if you're approaching the same sculpture in the art gallery from two different directions, and only later realizing that it's the same sculpture that you're seeing from different angles. So you can think of these early astronomers as seeing the planet Venus from different angles, down different vistas, and then only subsequently coming to realize that these different vistas were indeed homing in on the same object. And for that to be possible, of course, the object has to be able to present different aspects. So the De Re conception of sense doesn't have a problem with the Hesperus Phosphorus puzzle. I mean, you might initially think that it did, because you might think, well, if you really have got the planet Venus in mind, if you really are thinking of that very object when you use the name Hesperus, and again when you use the name Phosphorus, how can you possibly not know that Hesperus is Phosphorus? Because it's the same object each time, right? So why doesn't the sentence Hesperus is Phosphorus end up being just as trivial as the sentence Hesperus is Hesperus? You've got the object, it's in your mind. And it's in your mind both times, on both occasions of use of those names. So, you know, if it's as close as that, you might say, how can you not know it? And the answer is, because the object presents different aspects. Yes, you are grasping that object, you are cognizing that very object, but you're looking at it from one direction the first time round, and then the second time you're looking at it from another direction. And again, the art gallery analogy comes in very useful. It's very easy to see in that case that you can see a sculpture in an art gallery from two quite different directions, and you really are seeing it. You're seeing that very object. It's in your mind, but you're not realizing that it's the same object, not initially, because you're seeing it from different angles. It's presenting different aspects. So in order to be able to see it from different angles, for you to be able to associate two different modes of presentation with it, it has to have different aspects. It can't be an absolutely simple object. So another way of putting this would be to say, well, if there were such a thing as an absolutely simple object, an object which couldn't present different aspects, then indeed a Hesperus Phosphorus puzzle couldn't arise for that object, according to the De Re conception of sense. If you had the object in mind with the use of one name, and you had the same object in mind with the use of another name, then you'd have to know that, because the object itself would be utterly simple. It wouldn't present different aspects. If you had it there at all, you would know it in its entirety. There couldn't be anything you didn't know about it. Whereas if it's more like the sculpture in the art gallery, of course, there's plenty of things you don't know about it, even though it's in your mind. You see it, it's in your mind, but you're only seeing it from one direction, so you don't know what it looks like from another direction, right? So you can be fooled when you approach it from another direction and not realize that it's the same object again. And that couldn't happen, as I'm saying, with an absolutely simple object. Of course, this raises the question whether an absolutely simple object is conceivable. I mean, you might actually turn this all round and say, well, this is an argument for the inconceivability of an absolutely simple object. But anyway, we don't need to pursue that, fortunately, because Certainly the objects that we ordinarily encounter in the world are not absolutely simple. They do present different aspects. So the objects for which we need proper names do present different aspects. So we can say, as the De Re conception of sense does, that you really do have an object in mind when you have a mode of presentation of it, when you grasp a name of it down a particular avenue. You really have that object in mind, but only from a particular angle. And that means that if you have it in mind from a different angle, you may not realize that it's the same object that you have in mind. And that wouldn't be an irrationality on your part. On the contrary, that would be very understandable, and it's something that you would come to learn, or could come to learn, namely that it was the same object being presented in two different ways. And let me just finish off by saying something about the point of this alternative conception. I mean, you might say, well, what turns on this, whether we adopt Frege's conception of sense, which allows sense without reference, or adopt the alternative De Re conception, which doesn't? How do we decide that issue? And what is the point of going one way rather than the other? Well, the motivation for the philosophers who introduced and argued for the De Re conception of sense, so initially that was Gareth Evans and John McDowell, was really a motivation in the philosophy of mind, if you like. It was to ensure that mind was not cut off from the world. The worry was that if we conceived sense in the Fragean way as something that could be there without reference, so an intermediary between the word and the thing, an intermediary in the sense of something that could block access as well as grant access to the object. So if you're in control of the sense, if you've got the sense, you don't have a logical guarantee that there is a referent out there, that it will take you to an object. It may or it may not. And the worry with that conception of sense is that it threatens to divorce mind from world, that it threatens to imprison us in a sort of Cartesian theatre where we are stuck in the realm of our own conceptions and percepts. We don't have any kind of direct access to a world. We can only try to infer, and it's a very shaky inference, to the existence of a world beyond what's in our minds. Our minds themselves don't take us to the world. It's that old Cartesian conception that Wittgenstein spent so much time trying to upset, and which Evans and McDowell also want to challenge. And the idea behind the De Re conception of sense is that it gives us a way of seeing how mind can reach out and embrace world. Mind can contain world. So an object can actually be in your mind. So you're in the most direct possible contact with it. There isn't a gap to be bridged between mind and world. In being minded at all, in having a mind, you are thereby in contact with a world. Right? There aren't two separate stages, as it were, which there are on Descartes' picture. Stage one, you assure yourself that you've got a mind. You're a thinking thing. Stage two, is there a world out there? Is there an external world? You know, am I able to access it? That's a further separate question. On this De Re approach to sense, the two questions get scrunched together, because in settling the question whether you have a mind in the first place, you thereby settle the question whether you're in direct contact with the world. The answer is yes, because its objects are in your mind. That's what your mind is populated with, worldly objects. So I'm just sort of sketching in the motivation for the alternative conception. I won't be able to go into it in depth here, but I think you can see that there are sort of larger battles going on in the background here. This isn't just a sort of pernickety dispute in philosophical linguistics about Fragean sense. There's much more going on in the background. There's much more at stake. There are questions about how mind is located in the world, how we interact with the world. And the alternative De Re conception of sense is intended to provide a way of avoiding the Cartesian theatre the picture of subjects as imprisoned in their minds rather than of their minds as giving them automatic access to a world. Okay, I'll leave the matter there.